Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's the sound of the humpback whale. Philip Hoare established his passion for whales in a book called The Whale, In Search of the Giants of the Sea. His newest book is called The Sea Inside, a mix of acutely observed notes on nature, literary history, memoir, and travelogue of a year-long journey to rediscover the sea. Philip Hoare swims with whales in the Azores, dolphins in Tasmania, observes birds in Sri Lanka, and reflects on the tawdry beauty of the English coast. It is a love letter to the sea, with many steps off the path for unpredictable and amusing references about the animals, birds, and the humans who depend upon it. Philip Hoare, thank you so much for being here.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
In the epigraph to your book, you quote from the great Anglo-Saxon poem, The Seafarer. Can you recite that?
Even now my heart journeys beyond its confines, and my thoughts over the sea, across the whale's domain, travel afar the regions of the earth.
There's a lot of longing in that, a lot of restlessness. Is that what set you off on this year-long journey?
You are never comfortable with the sea. We were talking about this the other day. I've just come from Provincetown, where I've been doing a lot of whale watching. And we were talking on the boat that, you know, you're always on that moment of anticipation of seeing a whale. That's extraordinary, of course. And then the moment of seeing one is a kind of moment of transcendence. And then the moment afterwards is kind of, oh, when are we going to see it again? But also, you know, the sea is never comfortable. I mean, I never learned to swim until I was 25 because I was scared witless of the sea, even though I grew up in a port city in Southampton. And I suppose it's because the sea can give life and it can take life and it doesn't really care.
Hmm.
You know, you can't make an alliance with the sea. It's never a friend. There's a temporary sort of truce. But beyond that, you do not trust it, really.
I want to go back to this idea of the vastness of the sea. You remember the many conspiracy theories that developed when the Malaysia Airlines 470 went down. I mean, just reminded of people how huge and mysterious the sea is. And people were so shocked about not being able to locate something as big as a plane inside of the sea. I'm wondering what that shock revealed to you.
Oh, I just thought that was extraordinary because we believe we have extended our dominion over a sort of every square kilometre of the earth. You know, we can't believe that there are parts of the world that exist where we do not have control. So that notion of, you know, who does the sea belong to? Does the sea have a history? Does it have a culture? When increasingly now we're thinking that whales, for instance, have a culture. Whales and dolphins have a culture. It remains an enigma, even in the 21st century.
Well, let's get to the whales that you were just talking about. Your passion for them is just infectious. I learned so much about them. Now, you swim with sperm whales on a shoal off of the Azores. Tell us what you hear.
Yeah, it's kind of extraordinary. I think to slightly backtrack from your question is the notion that until the 1960s, we didn't realise these animals had a voice, really. And that's partly why we got away with doing what we did to whales. But in the Azores, where the sperm whale sleeps and inhabits this extraordinary depth of water, if you go just half a mile out from the shores of the Azores, it falls to 3 miles in depth. These are incredibly profound waters in the mid-Atlantic. And when you lower a hydrophone in the water there, you don't hear song, you hear...
Louder than a jet engine,
Louder than a jet engine. And, of course, sonar, which is what they're using, is the only way of hunting the food. But it's not only for hunting. It's for communication as well that the sperm whales use use those clicks. And they are, in fact, incredibly intelligent animals. The frontal lobes of a sperm whale's brain are highly convoluted. There's a lot of surface area there. And we know now that that's... makes them capable of tool use. And believe it or not, whales and dolphins do use tools.
What kind of tools?
Oh, well, they'll use, I mean, dolphins will use sponges to dig up food, prey. They will actually, dolphins will actually present potential partners with bouquets of seaweed, which is rather romantic. But sperm whales, we know, they communicate like dolphins with these click systems. And scientists now believe that, you know, not only they are communicating, but they might exhibit a sense of collective individuality. These animals who assemble in huge pods, but express themselves within those pods individually. To the extent that there's one great scientist, Hal Whitehead, working up at Dalhousie, Nova Scotia, posits the notion that whales, sperm whales, might have developed a sense of their existential self.
Yeah, your description of swimming them, it's actually a very sensual thing, a very beautiful experience, and huge and scary at the same time.
Of course. I mean, they're the biggest predator that had ever lived. Yeah. I mean, they're massive animals. But I've now learned that actually I have never felt so safe in the ocean as I have when I'm with cetaceans, almost as though they're a kind of protection in a way. And that's kind of not fantasy, really. Only 2 weeks ago, we had a swimmer off New Zealand who was saved from a shark by a dolphin. We think there is some kind of association that cetaceans recognize us as fellow mammals. Hmm. They know we are like them.
Philip Hoare is with us. His new book is called The Sea Inside. It's about the sea which defines us and connects us and separates us. Well, some of these stories of connection between humans and animals I found so fascinating. We meet St. Cuthbert, a medieval hermit who communicated with the otters and the seals, and the whales are as an extension of the dream time for the Aborigines. Has this connection, this ability to observe the intelligence of animals, which I think you do so beautifully in the book, gone the way of Aboriginal populations, fragile, tainted, removed from the modern world?
I wonder what effect human beings have had on animal culture. You know, because animals are subject to human influence right throughout history, and that's changed a lot. So, well, if you take the whale, for instance, you know, we regarded until the 1960s, you know, the whale as an industrial resource. And now we see it as a kind of environmental barometer, a symbol of ecological threat. Well, you know, out there in Provincetown, we're going to whale watch. We're going to hunt. Mm-hmm. You know, Provincetown, like New Bedford, was one of the great whaling ports of the Yankee whaling years. And now, you know, there's these boats going out there to whale watch. Well, they've got naturalists on them giving a narration over a tannoy system. Well, the whales, whose ultimate sense is sound, must hear those narrations. And they must hear these naturalists, and they give names to specific humpback whales, for instance. So a whale called Anchor, for instance, who's come back with her third calf from the Caribbean, the migration to the Caribbean. So the naturalist is giving this narration. Well, who's to say? I mean, your dog recognises its name. A whale, I'm afraid to say, is much more intelligent than your dog. Or who's to say the whale isn't reacting to its name? Who's to say the whale is now not performing? You know, how has the whale's culture changed in relationship to human culture? For instance, the grey whales of California were called devilfish because they fought back so ferociously against the hunters off Baja California. In fact, we realised they were doing that because they were protecting the calves. The hunters would kill the calf first and then that would draw in the adults. But now those same whales come right up to boats to be petted and patted.
I've done it myself.
Have you indeed?
The Bahia Magdalena in Baja California.
Wonderful. Well,
I mean, amazing experience.
I see in that a kind of forgiveness. I mean, that is anthropomorphic in a way. But, you know, these whales, I mean, grey whales we know to live to at least 70 years. You know, sperm whales are 100 years. Bowhead whales, 300 years.
Wowie.
These are animals that live in excess of our lives. That's what makes them so difficult to study in many ways. So they have seen humans come and go, centuries of humans come and go. All around the world, animals have reacted to human depredation and hunting. You know, they just do. And animal culture, which is passed down, especially in whales, as in elephants, as in many primates, is passed down matrilineally. That knowledge is passed down through the generation. We don't know. In 100 years' time, are we going to look around and say, why didn't you realise? Why didn't you know? What on earth were you doing? we've made huge steps. I mean, one of the great things the International Whaling Commission's moratorium on hunting whales back in 83, which was implemented in 1986, we're now seeing many more whales coming back to the coasts of Australia, of America, of Europe. You know, I mean, there's a 10% increase in humpback whale calves off the eastern coast of Australia now. This is, we should pat ourselves on the back for this. You know, we have done something good, you know.
So a returning population. And at the end of your book, you return home to Southampton. I wonder if, like the seafarer, do your thoughts always go back out to the sea?
It's never far from me. I was in my little attic room in Provincetown the night before last, and I was about to go to sleep, and the sea was rushing up against the bulkhead below my window, and the moon was nearly full, and it was shining on the sea, and I realised I couldn't go to sleep. Climbed down out of my bed, down into the sea, and like swam at midnight, and it was just magical, and I realised, I think this is my home, actually.
Philip Hoare, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much, Virginia.
Philip Hoare's new book is called The Sea Inside. You can see some of the terrific reviews of the book and also a list of where he'll be reading around the New England area at wordofmouthradio.org. We continue to ride the high seas. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll visit an underwater sculpture park and find out how works of art are helping to save the world's most vulnerable coral reefs.